is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
This is an emergency. It's 14 days. You can't be having a hospital that doesn't have water for 14 days.
That's Imtiaz Suleiman, head of the South African aid organization, Gift of the Givers, on problems that have caused water and power outages in Johannesburg hospitals just as the third wave of COVID-19 is hitting the country. Details coming up. Also, at least 23 migrants from Africa drowned as they were trying to cross the Mediterranean from Libya to Italy. And the parents of students abducted from the school in Nigeria 3 days ago are pleading for help to rescue them. These stories and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. Health activists say patients at several hospitals in Johannesburg, South Africa's biggest city, could die soon due to continuing water disruptions and power failures. To compound the situation, Johannesburg's largest hospitals remains closed after fire gutted part of it. Health organizations say the government is not doing enough to help end the crisis. Darren Taylor has more.
Authorities say there's no water in parts of Johannesburg as a result of infrastructure that failed because of poor maintenance. This, while patients seriously ill from COVID-19 and other conditions stream into the city's public hospitals. The head of aid organization Gift of the Givers, Imtiaz Suleiman, says his group's drilling a borehole at one of the facilities that's without water, the Rehema Musa Mother and Child Hospital.
Well, we're doing the work the government should be doing. And I keep saying the problem is they need to change their systems, how they operate. Individuals, you know, can't take the decision. They mean well, but the system ties their hands and they need to change the system. This is an emergency. It's 14 days. You can't be having a hospital that doesn't have water for 14 days at a time when you're trying to catch up.
Bongiwe Gambu of the Provincial Department of Infrastructure Development says her office is cooperating with the Johannesburg Municipality and the Rand Water Company to restore supplies.
We sympathize, and I cannot sit here and say we are doing as much as we can, therefore patients must understand. We fully understand the inconvenience and the health implications that are happening and unfolding as a result of this.
Gambu says her department sent water tanks to city hospitals. Suleiman says he's seen no evidence of that. What he has seen, he says, is Johannesburg's largest health facility, the Charlotte Maxeke Hospital, standing needlessly empty after a blaze destroyed a small section of it about a month ago.
I mean, the whole hospital didn't burn down. It was only one part of the hospital that burned, and surely at least two-thirds of the hospital could be functional by now. What's the delay?
Gambu responds that the fire affected five crucial sections of the hospital, but the biggest problem is that smoke damaged the air duct system.
Once you have dirty or below certain standards type of oxygen and airflow in those wards, it will definitely affect those patients.
Social activist Mark Haywood was at the hospital a few days ago.
I visited the site of the fire and saw where the floor had collapsed in the parking basement and saw no sign of construction or rebuilding there. And I spoke to a number of healthcare...
Gambu responds that repairs are happening, but adds that some can't be seen by the naked eye. She says her department will soon appoint a contractor to do the big repairs, but only after the correct bureaucratic procedures have been followed.
We cannot rush to fix things and then you find that in the end we have to undo some of that work because we try to rush. We are working together.
Haywood says he understands that the hospital must be repaired properly, but insists that the necessary proper work should have been done by now. He says doctors he's spoken with are angry and frustrated.
Their clinics are dispersed across the provinces, that patients are suffering. The hospitals that are taking their patients are suffering as well, because they are now facing both the third wave of COVID-19, and there's been a significant rise of new admissions in the last 2 weeks, together with severe pressure from managing the patients of the second largest hospital in the country, which is still closed.
To make matters worse, South Africa's national power regulator, weakened by years of corruption and mismanagement, says it'll be cutting electricity in stages across the country for at least the rest of the week. It also blames lack of adequate maintenance of equipment. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
Former UN envoy to Libya, Stephanie Williams, says the White House is sincere in supporting Libya's efforts to find a political solution to its long-running conflict, starting with elections scheduled for December. However, the road to voting faces major challenges that could lead to some unpleasant scenarios. Wolfgang Poschtei, former Austrian military attaché to Libya, discussed these hurdles with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi.
I would say there are two. One is the draft constitution and how to proceed with it, and the second one is the procedure for the election of the president. The draft constitution was elaborated by the so-called Constitution Drafting Assembly between 2014 and 2017. It's a weak compromise, leaving many critical questions open. The next step, as planned, should be a referendum which should seek for a majority in each of Libya's three provinces, which is very unlikely to happen. In the case of a rejection, the Constitution Drafting Assembly would need to rework the draft and prepare it for a new referendum. It could take years until Libya gets a new constitution, and it would be dangerous to postpone the elections that long. HCS Chair Al-Mishri and other Islamists urgently call for a referendum on the constitution. Otherwise, there would be a danger that the new president could become a dictator. They demand, in any case, the next president must be elected by the new parliament. This would not only give the Islamists a much better opportunity to influence who will become president, I would say they are unlikely to prevail in free and fair presidential elections, but also makes the president much less influential. Zahra Langi, Amal Bugaigis, and other female representatives of the Libya Political Dialogue Forum urgently call for elections in December and the direct election of the president in order to end, as they say, the corrupt oligarchy keeping the population in some kind of political quarantine. While it will be challenging to organize elections in December, and those will be certainly not perfect, I would say Langi and Bugaigis and the others are certainly right with their demand.
So what are the possible scenarios in Libya?
I see three potential scenarios. The first one and the best one would be an agreement within the House of Representatives in consent with the High Council of State within the next few weeks about an interim constitutional basis for the elections. This should allow elections as scheduled on December 24 or 1 or 2 months later. This would be certainly the best scenario for Libya, allowing to continue with a broadly accepted political process to stabilize the country. If there is no direct election of the president, the political process could end in some kind of stalemate, as we have seen it for years, with a fragmented parliament unable to make major decisions, and the president too weak to get his own way. But nevertheless, such an agreement would be the best scenario. The next one would be a referendum about the draft constitution, which would lead to a longer postponement of the elections, also confirmed by the head of the High National Election Commission. This would leave Libya with the GNU as a government for the years to come, which is, as said, probably Turkey's preferred solution. This would increase over time the differences between the parliament and the government, and also the tensions between the regions. And this could lead, again, to a major deterioration of the security situation. The worst and most dangerous scenario would be no agreement at all. This would mean that December would pass without a fixed election date and without preconditions for elections. The GNU would continue to serve on and lose its legitimacy over time, as they were scheduled to serve as a government only until December. This is, unfortunately, as said, the most likely and most dangerous scenario, as it could lead to a renewed outbreak of major hostilities. This brings me back to the importance of consolidating the ceasefire and establishing a credible monitoring mission as in some kind of insurance.
That was Wolfgang Poschtei, former Austrian military attaché to Libya, speaking with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi. At least 23 migrants from Africa drowned in a shipwreck off Tunisia as they tried to cross the Mediterranean from Libya to Italy. 70 were rescued. According to a Reuters report, they included 37 Eritreans, 32 Sudanese, and an Egyptian. They were handed over to the Red Crescent, an international organization for migration, in the southern port of Zarazis. More than 120 migrants have died in recent weeks in similar incidents off the Tunisian coast, as improved weather has increased the number of efforts to reach Europe by water. The UN Refugee Agency says fewer than 23,500 people have made it across the sea to Europe this year, with most new arrivals landing in Italy and Spain from Tunisia and Algeria. Cameroonian authorities say they are deporting more than 1,000 illegal gold miners on the country's eastern border with the Central African Republic after 27 miners died in May due to landslides. Those being expelled include 400 Central African and Senegalese in the village of Kambele, where Moki Edwin Kinzeka has this report.
At least 300 illegal miners were forced by Cameroonian police and military to sit on the floor at the Kambele Market Square on Tuesday night this week. Among them are Cameroonians, Central Africans and Senegalese. Alfred Kamum is a 31-year-old father of two from the neighboring Central African Republic. He says he was forced out of a mining site called Bukaru in Kambele village. He says he and his two brothers will no longer be able to raise $50 each night from digging and selling gold. He says while at the mining site, they could dig at least 7 grams of gold each night. Kamum says his son will no longer be paid $4 each night for supplying water to wash the gold. Kambele is a village in Baturi, an administrative unit located about 700 kilometers from Cameroon's eastern neighbor CAR. On Monday, local authorities at Baturi said 27 illegal gold miners died in Kambele village in May. Uberlen Belesa, mayor of Baturi, says an emergency crisis meeting recommended the deportation of at least 1,000 civilians from the risky mining area. He says no one can be indifferent when civilians are dying in gold mines, yet thousands of people continue to rush to mining sites, which from every indication are dangerous. He says while deporting the illegal gold miners, rescue workers and Cameroon military will also search to remove corpses and save the lives of people who may still be trapped in the collapsing mines. Cameroon said it deployed its rescue workers, military and police to Kambele to clear the area of illegal miners and make sure foreign illegal miners either obtain their residence and mining permits or leave. The military is prohibiting miners from visiting risk zones where trenches dug to harvest gold are collapsing. Baba Bell, traditional ruler of Kambele, says some civilians may have drowned in trenches filled with water from heavy rains.
Au retour des pluies, il y a toujours des accidents. Il y a ceux qui cassent les pieds, ceux qui cassent le bassin.
He says every year, during the rainy season, as from the month of April, so many gold mines collapse, leaving many people severely wounded or dead. He says a majority of the victims are unemployed Cameroonian youths who flood his village in search of opportunities. He says several hundred foreigners from Congo Brazzaville, Central African Republic, China and Senegal are in his village. Hilai Kembe is a Cameroonian illegal gold miner at Kambele village. He says it is impossible to know the exact number of dead or wounded people in May in Kembele. He says miners do not report when they discover fresh corpses and human bones at mining sites because of fear that they will be held for several weeks at police posts for interrogations. He says several hundred villagers and foreign miners whose identities are unknown prefer digging for gold at night when Cameroon police and military retire to their barracks. He says it is difficult to know when denied miners are buried by collapsing soils. Cameroon says some of the illegal miners are displaced persons fleeing the conflict in CAR and fleeing from Boko Haram terrorist groups on its northern border with Nigeria. Some are escaping from the Anglophone separatist fighters in the country's English-speaking western regions. The government has always prohibited unauthorized people from digging in the area, but many youths ignore the order, saying that they are unemployed. Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Kambele, Eastern Cameroon.
The parents of students abducted from a school in Nigeria 3 days ago are pleading for help to rescue them. Relatives of the 150 students gathered outside Sahilu Tanko Islamic School yesterday, waiting for news and asking authorities to do more to bring their children back. That's Rabiu Garkuwa, the father of two children abducted from a school in the Nigerian town of Tagina. He tells the Associated Press that he would say they do not have a government in their area because even before the kidnappers reached the school, the community was alerted, but the police took no action. He says that later the military came but only asked questions of the parents and then left. The students were abducted on Sunday, according to Malam Abubakar Gimi, director of the school in Tagina. Gimi said the abductors are demanding ransom and threatened to kill the children. Armed groups have carried out raids on schools in northern Nigeria, kidnapping hundreds of students since December. The Kano State government in northwest Nigeria says it has introduced free compulsory primary and secondary education. A top official of the government says the policy is aimed at easing the high rates of children not attending classes. The Nigerian government and UNICEF say the number of out-of-school children in the country stands at 10.1 million, an increase of more than 3 million from last year. Mohamed Saidu Sanusi is the Commissioner of Education in Kano State. He spoke with reporter Mike Mbonye about the situation, saying the government has cut the number of out-of-school children in Kano from 1.2 million to 400,000.
Well, as at the last count, the report indicates that we have about 1.2 million in Kano, but in 2018, according to the annual school census, we have 900. And in 2019-2020, it now dropped to 492. Because in between, His Excellency, the Executive Governor of Kano State, has introduced free and compulsory basic and secondary education in Kano, which of course increased our enrollment rate in Kano. Now, you see, the issue of out-of-school children is true, but you know in Kano we have high number of almajiri that are flowing in from other states and indeed the neighboring states. So in order to address the situation squarely, we repatriated some almajiris that are not Kano indigenous. We took them back to their respective states.
For the parents in Kano State, have they been responding to government gesture or offer of free education for such young ones known as almajiri?
Yes, exactly. Even if the parents want to respond, you have to provide the enabling environment for them to respond. And that is why I'm telling you that the out-of-school children, the figure dropped from 1.2 to 900 and now to 400 as at the last count. Now, In between, His Excellency has provided more classrooms, more classroom furniture, more secondary schools. I'm talking of primary schools. We have rehabilitated dilapidated structures in primary schools. At a point, His Excellency even released 880 million to our 44 local governments to rehabilitate dilapidated classrooms. And at secondary school level, the Minister of Education has now embarked on massive renovation and rehabilitation of dilapidated structures. Because even if you want to have more enrollment, then you need to provide the infrastructure, the facilities where the students will learn, will stay, the classes, and so on and so forth.
So you're saying that you intend bringing down this figure drastically in the years to come?
Exactly. And you see, because we have declared the education free, the effort being put in place by government, it must be continued and it must be sustained. We declared education free, so a lot of parents are now sending their children because we say it's compulsory, and it is an offense for a parent to even refuse sending his children to school. So by so doing, government must put in place a reliable source of funding the education sector, and that is why we signed into law, His Excellency signed into law Education Development Funds, which is a parastatal under the Minister of Education.
That was Muhammad Saidu Sanusi, Commissioner of Education in Nigeria's Kano State, speaking with reporter Mike Mbonier. An attack that killed 6 Chadian soldiers at a border post with the Central African Republic, CAR, will be jointly investigated by the two countries after a high-level meeting yesterday appeared to ease tensions. The French news agency AFP says Chad initially blamed the attack on soldiers from CAR, saying its soldiers were abducted and executed last Sunday. Chad accused the Central African Republic of committing war crimes that would not go unpunished. But CAR blamed the incident on rebels it said its soldiers had been pursuing. Since then, the Central African Republic has condemned the attack and expressed its profound sympathy to the government and people of Chad. And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiyi Suwuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbili Abaro, thank you again for tuning in and choosing the Voice of America.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of Press Conference USA, VOA's newsmaker interview program. Join us each Saturday and Sunday when we talk with authors, analysts, and policymakers who provide fresh insight on topics ranging from U.S. politics and foreign policy to science, culture, and global health. You can listen to Press Conference USA on the radio or online at voanews.com/PCUSA. While you're visiting our website, be sure to subscribe to our podcast. We'd also love to hear from you. Just send an email to pcusa@voanews.com or connect with us on Facebook at facebook.com/CarolCastielVOA or on Twitter at CarolCastielVOA. That's Press Conference USA every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
The Voice of America's Global News Program, International Edition, brings you an in-depth look at the biggest news stories of the day. Nobody covers the world more comprehensively than VOA. Our correspondents gather the news and the views of the most seasoned experts on international issues. Tune in Monday through Friday at 3:30 and 17:05 UTC on The Voice of America.
Join your host, Larry London, for Border Crossings, VOA's Worldwide Music Request Hour, every weekday at 1500 Universal. Tune in to hear your favorite songs and artists, win prizes and giveaways, and get the latest scoop from exclusive celebrity interviews. Send in requests to our Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram, or call 202-618-2077 to have your favorite music played for the entire world. Don't miss Border Crossings every weekday at 1500 Universal.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African beat. African Beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music, from bobo music to hip life, bonga flavor to soukous, afrobeat to dumbolo and makossa to kwaito. The African Beat on VOA has it all. And it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 09:05 and 20:05 UTC, right after the interview.